At 1:30, would you believe? Monday, March 14th, let the record show Representative Pierce, Representative Miller, Representative Springer, and Chairman Representative Cato are in attendance. I'd like you to look at this bill that I'd like to have the committee introduce. It's kind of a Good Samaritan bill. And I would like the committee to introduce this. It's a lot like your Good Sam bills on the, you know, where EMTs take care of somebody on the highway and stuff like that. Then they're absolved from liability. Do I have the committee's permission to introduce this bill?
Is there anything in section 965092? Are we just adding that one
sentence? We're adding it. Just the one sentence right down below.
Amending it.
Right. Is there any objection to introducing the bill? Hearing none, we'll do so. We need some more bills in committee anyway. We'll take a short recess while we're waiting for Deputy Commissioner Poe. Drew, I read with interest your deal on the political careers.
Wasn't that a good article?
Yeah, a real good one.
Now, when I read the stuff in the papers that just slams us consistently, kind of all politicians as a whole, and like government service, their career as a whole, it really kind of irritates me because there is a sense that you get what you get. If you don't expect a lot of your people, you're not going to get it.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure I could have stood up and voted against voted against burning the flag.
Yeah, I would have had a hard time with that one.
But I understood his point.
Yeah. And yet, you know, what I was interested in that point there is that he has the same type of background I had on that. Like he'd been in the military. And that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But I'm not sure I would have had enough courage to do that. Like I tried to vote against saying the pledge every day. And my reasoning on that is that not our body necessarily, but so much of the time when I was in college in various places, it was lip service.
Sure.
I mean, and, but I didn't have courage enough to vote no on that either.
What, I don't even know what you guys thought about.
You got in your box on Friday or on the floor or somewhere a four-page article from me out of the Kennedy School of Government spring bulletin talking about service.
We got a super quorum.
Yeah, we sure have. Let the record show that Representative Hudson has joined us. We're waiting. We, without your consent, decided to send that bill out as a Transportation Committee bill.
Okay.
It's a Good Sam bill for aircraft. That's what it is.
Okay.
And then we can argue the merits of it when it gets to us. I think it's a good bill myself. You won't believe it, I'm doing it for a Republican.
I can believe that.
I was just up in K. Brown's subcommittee on the campaign reform.
Well, have you been reformed? Are you doing for a good Democrat?
Yeah, are you reformed?
Are you reformed?
Are you well reformed?
Set baby don't know if it wants to come out or slide back in.
I think it needs to slide back in.
I think it needs to break through someplace.
Ye gods, our chief witness just showed up.
I'm going to be tabled to go on this.
Shall I take my motion seriously, Representative Miller?
My apologies to the committee. I had a 50-50 chance of being right or wrong with which committee I was supposed to be at first, and I beat the odds.
Oh, great. Back into regular session. Representative, you got that, didn't you, Bob? Deputy Commissioner Poe, did you wish to speak to SB 342?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chairman. For the record, my name's Bob Poe. I'm Deputy Commissioner with the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. The bill you have before you today is a bill to essentially expand the alternatives the international airports have to use in awarding the duty-free concessions at the international airport. At present, The airport can only award those contracts through competitive bid. That is, all the firms who want to win that concession simply specify how much money they will give the airport for the opportunity to do business there. And that's the only criteria we can select a winner on. We can't base it on their past experience in doing this or their demonstrated ability to actually deliver what they promised or any of that. We simply have to award based on the top dollar amount. This is the only contract at the airport that's like this. All other concessions we can award through competitive bid, all purchasing and professional services we can do through competitive bid. Only the duty-free has this limitation, and the statute AS0215091 is that portion of the law that restricts us. Now, the duty-free concession of the international airports, for those of you who haven't heard my speech on this before, is that it produces about $95 million in revenue, of which the airport receives $17 million, between 15 and 17. And that is the largest single revenue source to the international airports. Far and away much better, bigger than Flying Tigers or Japan Airlines or any of that. The duty-free concession is where we make a tremendous amount of money. It makes it the most valuable square foot of retail space, or if not the one of the top five most valuable square foots of retail space in the world. So I think the thing to recognize about the duty-free concession is that Alaska has a very important asset here, and it's very key that we protect that asset, that the earning ability of that asset. The airport is confronted by two major changes in the way traffic moves in the world today, air traffic, and those are the opening of Siberian airspace, which you've all heard about probably too many times, and the advent of the 747-400, which can fly either over Siberia direct nonstop from Tokyo to London or Paris or Frankfurt, or it can fly around Siberia nonstop to those locations. But in either case, it never has to even wave to Alaska, let alone stop there. So that's one point to consider. That's the environment that's confronting us. Now, the second element is that the duty-free concession has not always earned this much money. A lot of why the duty-free concession does so well is because of aggressive marketing tactics on the part of the concessionaire that's in there. They do an awful good job selling. Now, that's not as a commercial for that particular vendor, but simply to point out that the way you market, the way you do business, has as much a factor in what revenue you'll generate as your ability to offer some sort of product there. I know Representative Cato has toured the duty-free operation at the North Terminal, and it is a very, very impressive place. The quality of the goods are the kind that an international traveler demands. The folks that help you with your merchandise speak Japanese or they speak Korean, and it's all based on which planes are coming through the international terminal. If you ask most Japanese international travelers what they know about Alaska, they can tell you about the Alaska Club, which is this duty-free shoppers club and card that they get, but they probably couldn't tell you much about Alaska. In fact, probably most Japanese know, you know, they know more about the Alaska Club than they know about Alaska. And those factors are the layout, the quality of the materials, the marketing that they provide, and those sorts of things. As it is right now, when that concession comes up in May of 89, we won't be able to award that contract on any basis other than who offers us the most money. So a real risk, there are four or five companies in the world today that operate this world-class kind of a duty-free operation. What we want to make sure, and through this change we're trying to make sure, is that we're able to consider other factors that over the long haul will maximize the investment in your asset, the duty-free concession. And let me show you a couple of examples of why this is important. As an example, in the Anchorage terminal, we had a gift shop concession, which isn't as by any means in the same ballpark in terms of being lucrative as is the duty-free concession, but it's still the same dynamics. We had a company that proposed a very high payback to the airport. The revenue from the gift shop wasn't making the revenue they'd anticipated, and it was essentially driving them broke. So they pulled out. Now, we're in this situation, we're in a suit with an Alaskan company. If we win the suit, we might make them bankrupt, which we don't want to do. the space was held vacant for quite some time while we had to work out getting the space transferred back to the airport, because when we awarded it, it's under contract, it's actually with that contractor at that time. So, you know, there we had a revenue generating space that we couldn't do anything with. And in addition, we're now entangled in a suit that's expensive to the state, and we're entangled with the question of, do we drive an Alaskan business out of business just to do our job, which is, hey, you contracted, you know, it's time to fess up. So if we'd been able to look at other factors, we might have been able to package it so that both sides would have had better success. You're finding this is a regular trend around airports all around the country. They try to consider other factors other than just who's going to offer the most money. That's why you see a lot of theme kind of restaurants and things in airports today, and new ideas and those sorts of things. Because you can essentially design your concourses and so forth to provide a mix of services by having some flexibility. But if all you're doing is dollars, then you're very restricted in how you can package the revenue generating opportunities at that airport. The other thing I might want to mention is that in terms of the International Airport Revenue Fund, there is only one way that the airport can essentially make a profit, and that is through the management incentive fee related to concession revenues. The way the airline operating agreement works is that essentially airlines are willing, through their payment of the landing fee essentially, to finance the cost of the international airports. It costs in terms of cost of operations, depreciation, and debt service. Okay, now they'll do that, but they'll do that less the money we make from concession revenues. So that $17 million that we get from duty-free comes right off the top, and we say, well, our expense is less $17 million. And then same way with the restaurants and gift shops and so forth. Those are all subtracted from that cost of operations plus debt service plus depreciation. Now the airport gets to keep 10% of that concession fees. That's the only place under the current agreement the airport has an opportunity to make any profit. So the more flexibility that we're able to get in terms of the way we contract on those concessions, we believe the better job we can do to protect those revenue generating assets for the state. That's pretty much the sum total.
Any questions?
Bob, how do you, you know, looking at other factors, a proposal of other factors, what kind of expertise does the state have to address things other than, and I agree with the idea, because we've dealt with this and everything from major advertising agency contracts to a lot of other things, because you don't just go to the low bid. If you go to the low bid, there's no assurances whatsoever that you're going to get a major productive program in return. But what kind of expertise? Do you have the ability to maybe bring in an outside expert that might be able to, say, review a number of proposals to determine whether or not, you know, this is going to produce additional revenue?
We sure do. And I might add, Representative Hudson, that the criteria that you see in the bill that's before you, it's listed in the bill there. That criteria came from a marketing analysis that Pete Marwick and Mitchell did for the airports. Pete Marwick and Mitchell does have a lot of expertise in airports. They've sort of set out that niche for themselves in terms of consulting. And in that report that they produced, I think it was 2 years ago, they said that the duty-free contracts should be awarded, and then you can literally quote out of the study what's in this piece of legislation. After considering factors that include depth of management, financial ability, demonstrated experience, and so forth, all those things that are in the bill. That came right out of a study that airport experts suggested.
So then in following, Madam Chair, I guess what you'd do then would be looking at all of these other elements here with the assistance of somebody like Pete Marlin. I haven't been in the duty-free shop really for years, quite frankly. I was back there when I was with the Seafood Marketing Institute because we were trying to get some of our product, and we were also trying to use the that part of the airport as sort of a marketing tool for our product as well. And so we provided a lot of the brochures and the, you know, the
posters and that kind of stuff.
I think you'd be happy to go in there today because one of the things that's interesting is that when you look at all the seafood displays, we do have those in there, they literally stole the Yasmi logo as a
No, they asked for it, as a matter of fact.
Well,
we gave
yeah,
them.
No, I was joking. But it is the same logo or theme as Yasmi put out. And I think you also make an awfully good point. Bob Coe from Alaska Duty Free was down here, I think it was last Thursday or Friday. And
Wednesday?
Okay. And Commissioner Hickey and I met with him and discussed some ideas we have in terms of how the international terminal could be used to get Alaska's message across more. And I think that we have a trade-off coming up. On one hand, the downturn in transit passengers that we will expect because of the because of 747-400 and the Siberian airspace does mean a downturn in revenues that Alaska Duty Free will receive. Now, whoever wins that contract in May of 89, they have the same problem. They have to maximize what they get out of those in-transit passengers, and if we all agree that destination tourism is the best way to supplant that loss in-transit passengers, then it's in there, they have a stronger incentive today to help develop that market. Before, what they do is say, well, if you like that $17 million in revenue, you take any time that these people have to shop away from them by looking at some movie on Alaska or what have you, and you're going to be getting a lot less revenue. Today, I think that might be softening. Maybe a movie isn't the best way. Maybe there are other better ways to promote Alaska and to get that message across. But I think that there's a lot of incentive to look at that a little more carefully today.
Representative Pierce?
Yeah, I would think that when you just climbed off an airplane and you have to climb back on for another 4 or 5 hours, the movie's the last thing you want to go and sit down and have a watch. How long do we know how long the new contract will be, or is that also negotiable within the
proposal? I think it's negotiable.
What's the present contract?
What's it?
4 years left.
4 years. Thank you very much.
Is Duty Free Alaska a wholly owned subsidiary of? Is the parent firm an American firm?
I think it's a limited partnership, and I think it is an American firm. I think it started in Hawaii.
Did any of the other multinational companies that do duty-free type things bid the last time around?
It's my understanding some did.
Okay, so we would expect to see some other proposals.
I would suspect
probably
some.
Come in from some of the other
like Amsterdam is an example, which is renowned as having a good one.
Has there been any interest on the part of any of the airlines?
Not that I've heard yet. They do it on their airplanes themselves. So JAL does it, and I know British Airways does it.
Thinking about JAL trying to do a destination, it wouldn't surprise me to see them come in and be interested in it. The only thing, Madam Chairman, I want to put on the record is on line 20, when we talk about considering factors that include depth of management, it occurs to me, and there are a couple of other cases, where we end up not allowing Alaskan firms, or where Alaskan firms get not disqualified, but lose points on proposals and contracts with the state because of depth of management. And it's because they're smaller companies than the companies outside. And let's say, hypothetically, that Bob Coe decided that he wanted to spin off from Duty Free and become his own new Bob Coe International Duty Free, whatever. Because of depth of management, we might lose the opportunity to have someone with a great deal of personal expertise who is an Alaskan, who I think is very much committed to the state, from being able to get the contract, because when you talk depth of management, they're not 5 or 6 people deep, perhaps. And I would just like the DOT not to get itself in a position in the future where that becomes such a major part of these awards that you can never get an Alaskan firm involved. And I don't think Bob's certainly going to do that, but it's something to be concerned about, not just in this contract, but in other contracts.
I think, I'd argue with the exact opposite direction. If you take your hypothetical example again, you said Bob Coe as an example, broke away and wanted to start an Alaskan firm. I'd say that's where your depth of management is. I mean, who has the hands-on experience in the team?
Yeah, but by depth, you usually mean four or five people deep as opposed to just one. Because I've heard DOT do it. They say, well, what happens if we lose you?
Well, that can certainly happen. And in the case of you have 17 million annual revenue, and multiply that by five, that's how much that asset was worth over the last 5 years. You do want to be careful, and I think we have to be responsible in terms of managing it. But I came from a consulting background where, again, you know, when I wanted to go compete on a project and, you know, some highfalutin consulting firm from Boston came up, I'd have to win. You know, I'd want to try to win. Well, the way I would win is to get in partnerships with other folks that brought some of that depth of management. And I think that if an Alaskan firm wants to win this, they're going to go out and have to seek that expertise, however they do it. And there's a lot of ways to do it. Right. Partnerships is one way. I think to eliminate depth of management, you know, because it might exclude an Alaskan firm would be a mistake. I think that if you, I think I agree with Representative Pierce in terms of weighting. It doesn't have to be the most heavily weighted factor. And the other is that I think if an Alaskan firm really wants to win, and really wants, not because they're Alaskans, but because they can do the best job, then they can do that by getting other folks involved. Now, I have to admit, I have a bias towards an Alaskan firm, but I would not want to see them go in there and fail. What I'd like to do is to see Alaskans winning, Alaskans being successful.
Yeah, you know, there's an old adage on that, and that is that if you don't have the expertise, you hire it. So
that's
you
right.
can hire the depth in management.
That's right. But show me you got it. Don't promise it to me.
Right.
Oh, yeah. I agree. I mean, it should certainly be there. Yeah.
Representative Sperry?
Well, I have mixed feelings about it. And the reason I have mixed feelings about it is looking at the International Airport Revenue Fund. Right now, it's a real clear-cut and dry deal. Mm-hmm. That is, you award on the basis what brings the most cash to the fund.
Mm-hmm.
Not too long ago, DOT was in the same situation with professional services contracting. And I submit to you that also things I read here, depth of management, financial ability, demonstrated experience at other locations, quality of services and products, success in marketing programs, character improvements at proposed facilities. Those are all scientifically non-qualifiable quantities. They're all open to judgment. As soon as you start doing that, you open the door for hanky-panky. And I'm not saying there has hanky-panky happened in professional services contracts, but so close to it that you can say yes. And there are two other subdivisions in that. Number one, you can have a damn good firm that has the best intentions and everything, but doesn't have a track record. It's being left out. It's the same old deal like limited entry phishing or something like that, when everything is based on some kind of a track record of some kind. What that usually does is that invites them to bring phony cronies in there. That what you do is you load up your paper with so-called partners or other firms that fulfill those points but who are not running there, either in there on a small percentage basis, or the thing is so dubious that you don't know exactly what their role is. Professional services contracts typically is you get 16 resumes from PhDs with whole long backgrounds, and then on the rear end it says project manager, somebody you don't know. And they get qualified on the basis here are all them big deals. All they're going to do is they get a percentage of the money, but they never show up. They don't have any influence on the whole thing at all. And I'm really torn because of that. In one way, you want to give the departments that flexibility, but at the same time, if you give the departments that flexibility, you open the gate to politically influencing, to power peddling, and everything else.
Hey,
in
response to that, I think Representative Springer has some real good points, and those all have occurred in professional service contracting. I've been a professional service contractor for a long time. I've seen it happen at all different levels. One of the things that's happened in Alaska since I first came here in 81 and was on maybe one of the biggest professional service contracts that probably had the most sole source activity of any that I'd ever seen in my life, is that Alaskans have gotten a lot smarter in their professional service contracting. The RFPs that go out today are a lot better crafted. They're designed to poke holes in things like, are these folks here for the ride? Are they here to really do something substantive? So I think that an RFP can be designed that can eliminate Representative Springer's concerns in terms of phony cronies and so forth. On the other side, that is, these are qualitative aspects as opposed to clearly quantifiable aspects. I agree, they are qualitative. On the other hand, I don't know how many of you caught the article in the Times this weekend on airport marketing. It was a pretty positive article. And what they said is essentially things are 100% better today than they were 2 years ago when the department didn't think about airport marketing at all. And that's true. We could sit back and say, hey, we run an airport. You know, when they crash, we take care of it. You know, we try to keep the place safe. We move people in and out. Things work. The lights work. The escalators work. And beyond that, you know, we just do the same contracts we've always done, and we don't have our brains turned on. And that's really what we're talking about here. We need to we're charged with the job of managing that tremendous resource for Alaska. And it does have a lot of opportunities, the cargo opportunities, the additional destination tourism opportunities that it can present. And those are all management. Those are all things that we do because our brain is turned on. And I think on the same token here with this contract, it's a very important one to the health of the airport. We just want the opportunity to be able to affect the destination in a positive way, affect affect the results in a positive way, as opposed to just have numbers do our thinking for us. And that's what you have in a bid. You just essentially throw it out there and hope that a good bid comes through.
Representative.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Bob, picking up on Henry's involvement into this thing there, on his concerns about maybe failure to consider competitive bid, you know, that being sort of a fixed figure that we've always been able to rely upon as bureaucrats. It seems to me like there ought to be both a competitive bid based upon competitive proposals, so that you look not only at certainly the price, you know, that kind of a fixed figure is one of those key essential elements that you look at under even under a proposal type of thing. But if you were to expand that process so that you looked at a number of different things, not only the bid, but also the other things like financial ability, demonstrated experience. In Drew's case, depth of management might be a poor choice of words. It might be related management experience or something like that, so that you could...
Would you be talking about like a pre-qualification?
Sort of like
of
that,
deal?
Yeah.
And that might be possible. It wouldn't be possible the way the statute's written
now. But if it would, I think, if you had... the department shall offer the exclusive contracts required by this section by competitive bid, predicated or as submitted through competitive proposals or something like that.
Yeah, I think the one thing that...
No, it says or by.
Or.
So in essence, this is an either-or type of thing. You either go competitive bid or you switch all the way over and look at all these other elements. I'm saying that it ought to be a combination.
A third animal out there.
Yeah.
And that's where you get into all sorts of trouble is that, you know, we've got all these procurement regulations and things that talk about two different animals.
Mm-hmm.
It's a competitive bid and a competitive proposal. And if you create that one in the middle, then the lawyers will never be able to figure out what it is at all. What I would suggest to you is, it's true, I mean, just walking through them with this was amazing to me. But the, just the way they think. But the thing that you could do, and I think that we need to wait and see, as Representative Pierce asked before, who's expressed interest. I think we need to find out who's interested. But one of the things we could do is to establish a minimum, okay?
Yeah.
That you need not propose if you can't guarantee a certain revenue level, and then beyond that, we consider these other factors. Okay, so that once we've got a certain, and maybe that's $15 million a year under the new, you know, forecasts of traffic, and I don't know what that number is yet. I think we need to think that through. You could do a pre-qualification under, you know, nobody that won't provide a number over this amount to need apply.
So a minimum bid.
Minimum bid,
and then the actual selection predicated on
a competitive proposal.
Competitive proposal.
Yeah. There's a lot of things like that, but without this additional flexibility, we can't even look at those kinds of alternatives.
Okay.
I do know, Madam Chair, that you know, just the last major bid effort that went out, because this is such a lucrative contract, as you said, what is it, 96?
95
million dollars. 17 million, you know, goes back out into the state. I mean, this is a pretty doggone hot potato here.
Pretty important stuff.
Yeah, very important stuff.
And
yeah.
what we feel we're in a position of is just throwing the dice and hoping the way it is now, where it's just competitive bid, and hoping that we get a good contractor who can deliver a decent source of revenue. But there's no guarantee of that at all. And I think that with these additional flexibilities, we could help guarantee that a little bit better. That's where we're coming from.
Bob, would we be, though, with this language here, do you think we would be really putting this entirely out of the hands of any Alaskans to ever?
No, not any qualified Alaskans. I think it's a question of getting a qualified team together.
You think so?
I have no comment.
You didn't say that.
But there certainly are Alaskans who know the international business and can put together those partnerships that make it happen. But, you know, even the contractor we have in place right now is a limited partnership. I don't really see how you, as an Alaskan, I don't see how I would propose about a partnership of some kind. But I still say that could happen.
Just on that point, you've got to be pretty careful what Alaskan may be. Just for the record, there are over 4,000 Koreans in Anchorage alone. And if you take a look at that so-called limited partnership there, white skin is hard to come by. And they're all qualifying for Alaskans, but there is definitely, considering the clientele, and like we hear, the staff and the buying power is from Japanese, Koreans, Taiwanese, Chinese, and so on. That's, of course, where the marketing and the whole PR effort is. Mm-hmm. But there are Alaskans.
And they also don't pay very much.
Pardon me?
They also don't pay very much. And they can tap into that.
Yeah.
They tap into the Korean community and the Japanese community.
It is critical to successful marketing, though, because if they don't speak Japanese, they don't
understand the culture. It's not a criticism. Okay. I'm not criticizing. I'm just pointing something out. Yeah.
It's a perfect niche.
Yeah, it really is. Fantastic. It makes me wish I'd studied foreign languages a lot better.
I'm thinking about if I could stay in one place for 2 weeks at a time, I would do it.
Is there any further discussion on the bill or questions to Mr. Poe? If not, then the chair would entertain a motion to move the bill out of committee.
So moved.
Representative Hudson moved that we pass SB 342 out of committee. I assume with individual recommendations.
Thank you very much.
So ordered.
Are we looking at committee substitute for Senate bill?
I think you're going to be there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's what came to us. From the Senate. Bob, didn't I do a good job by not having anybody put you on the spot?
I think you did.
Other items?
Thank you very much, Madam Chairman. I appreciate it. And I'll see you on Wednesday. In fact, I have something here for you. We're going to talk on Wednesday, right?
Yeah.
You can't have a value of more than $5.
Thanks very much.
Oh, bye. Meeting is adjourned at 2:07.
Are we going to deal with this?